must have spoken to the head teacher. On 28th of July 1975, the social worker visited.
I called to see Norman today, the family having just returned from a holiday in Scotland. Mrs. Greenwood was upset. It seems that Norman had been getting up in the early hours and eating sweet foods, particularly biscuits, as many as 2 packets.
For the record, I did steal biscuits, but not 2 whole packs. One holiday in Scotland, at my granddad's home, the family left me in the cottage as punishment for lying about stealing some cake. I thought I'd been locked in my room, but the door was open. I sobbed my way downstairs. I saw on the table a half-cut ginger cake. The tears evaporated, replaced by butterflies in my stomach. If I cut it in exactly the same way as it was already cut, then nobody would notice that I had taken a slice. Genius! And so I did. It tasted so good. So I did it again. To this day, I don't know why I got into this habit of stealing biscuits and bits of cake, but I did. They told me I was devious. The problem was that my first instinct was to say, I didn't steal the cake. The lies worried them more than the theft. Stealing cake and lying about it was an indication that the devil was working inside of me. Within 3 years, it will be reported that I threatened to kill the entire family except for baby Helen. Look what was sown by the stars at night across the fields. I am not defined by scars, but by the incredible ability to heal. It was run by the elders, Bryn Baptist Church, a mile from our home, and a mile from Grandma and Grandad Munro. Church was full of horrific stories. People drowned in the huge flood, and Jesus stabbed with huge nails and hung on a wooden cross. Repent, repent for your sins. The temperature rose with the pastor's words. Mum threw up her arms, praise him. So I threw up mine. Was I saved by Jesus? I spent 12 years kneeling and praying, and it was the powerful rhetoric and lyricism of the church that took me to poetry. There is barely any mention of religion in my files. It wasn't discussed with a social worker.
The child has an extrovert personality and is attention-seeking. The foster parents' own children are somewhat overshadowed by this child.
Winnick was a sprawling red brick institution set in manicured greenery. Mum, me and Chris walked through the front door, and after Mum signed a register, we stepped into the wide, tiled corridor of the asylum. Our footsteps led to a big public room with lots of winged armchairs with women in them. Mum spotted one of them and stepped quietly over to her. She had an overhang to her mouth, wolf-like, hair like a nest, and she was rocking backwards and forwards. Say hello to your auntie. Hello, auntie. Her twisted elbow pushed out a clawed hand towards me and brushed my cheek. She couldn't speak. Mum took out a hanky and lovingly wiped drool from Auntie's mouth and chin, and I knew instinctively not to ask questions. Mum visited her twin regularly, sometimes alone, sometimes with us. My auntie had been like that from birth. My grandmother never visited her daughter with my mum and us. Did my mum blame herself? Was Catherine living with a constant sense that she was not good enough because she had taken the heir from her twin sister? She would do everything to prove otherwise. She would foster a black baby and show her mother that she was good. I saw Grandma at least once a week and I loved her. Maybe she did love Catherine, the twin that survived. but Catherine never felt it and subsequently found love difficult to give. Mum was a state-registered nurse. At the hint of a scratch or bump, she'd draw the medical kit from the top of the kitchen cabinet. I'm not sure I ever felt as close to her than when she'd say, "This is going to hurt," before dabbing my grey's knee with a pinch of cotton wool soaked in witch hazel. It's because she was a nurse that she had the comb. Each morning before school, I'd stand by the heater in the kitchen, and Mum dragged the comb through the roots until my skull felt like it had been dipped in acid. "You have hair sore," she'd say. Apparently, hair sore was a medical condition. Then on a spring day, Mum got me up in my best shirt and trousers. I was going to meet a pop star. Errol Brown was the lead singer for Hot Chocolate. Mum took me to an apartment in Winstanley. I remember there were bowls of nuts and crisps, and it wasn't even Christmas. Errol Brown chatted to me about school. He was black, like me. I was nervous and intrigued all at the same time, and then he left the room and came back with a present for me. I stared at the strange and elegant genius of design, an afro comb. He'd been visiting a newborn child of a family friend at the hospital. Mum was the midwife on call, and they must have got talking about me. Maybe she showed him the thin-toothed comb she'd been using. Maybe he winced and gritted his teeth to stop him saying, "His hair is Ethiopian hair. Why did you not get this boy an afro comb?" On 19th of April 1978, the social worker writes,
"There is a letter on file from Norman's mother, written in 1968, requesting that he be returned to her in Ethiopia. Perhaps Norman should be made aware of this."
And underneath, a handwritten comment,
"Not yet, I think."
The social worker's report continues,
"The Greenwoods are seen by Norman as his parents."
Why would the social worker say that? They told me they were my parents forever. Why would I think anything else? As with most brothers close in age, Christopher and I fought like snakes on each other's territory. Christopher always, even in the midst of thrills, betrayed a fretfulness. I had no idea that Mum thought it was my fault. We raced each other home from school every single day, and every single day I beat him. I waited in the kitchen by my mum. He dived into Mum's arms and said, Mum, I beat Norman, didn't I?" She stroked his head, and then she looked at me.
"Yes, you did."
1973. I've only two school reports from my infants and junior schools.
"Norman is a carefree and happy child and is an asset to the class. His lively personality makes him popular with the other children."
11th of July, 1978. My junior school report. I am 11 years old.
"Norman is an enthusiastic worker. He is cooperative and eager to please. Norman is a most likeable boy. A ray of sunshine."
12th of July, 1978, the social worker's response.
"Discussed Norman with Miss Jones, who has a quite pathetic attitude towards the child, purely based on his colour. See recent report where she refers to him as ray of sunshine. Hopefully the staff at his new school will be more realistic."
December 1978, the social worker reports that Mrs. Greenwood had a daughter. Her name was Helen. It was an unexpected pregnancy. The household now had four children and two adults. The social worker received a phone call on 13th of May 1979, 8 days before my 12th birthday.
"Phone call from Mrs. Greenwood. A row with Norman had resulted in him threatening to kill all members of the family, except baby Helen. Mrs. Greenwood had reacted by packing him off to her mother's visit, and Mrs. Greenwood very upset. The row had developed from Norman badgering Chris to loan him his cricket stumps. Mrs. Greenwood had advised Chris not to loan them, as Norman is extremely careless with equipment. Norman had told Chris that the decision was his and not their mum's. Mrs. Greenwood lost her temper and told him to leave."
Home was hell. I couldn't do anything right. The better I did, the worse I was treated. I was deceitful. I was tricking everyone into thinking I was a good kid. For the life of me, I didn't understand. On 16th of June 1979, a visit from the social worker.
Some 10 minutes with Norman on his own. The incident had clearly shaken Norman. He admitted to difficulties of controlling his temper, but insisted that he had not meant what he said. He did recognise that his mum was under strain, although he didn't know why. Told him some of the reasons, and his response was, "If only I had realised."
I didn't threaten to murder the family. Full disclosure, I probably said to my brother, "I'm going to kill you." Brothers say things like that in the heat of the moment. The following report by my new social worker is from 2nd of November 1979.
Mrs. Greenwood told me that they had been to a parents' evening at school last night and that there had been very unfavourable reports about Norman. She says that she sometimes thinks Norman is amoral. She told me that he smokes, swears, steals, and he seems to harbour a grudge about being black. She said that she was at the end of her tether.
The only report from my high school is from the summer of 1979.
Well behaved in lessons. Always keen to please and has many friends. Norman has settled down well in his first year.
I felt like I'd done everything to show them that I love them. And I'd done everything to show God that I loved God. And they were still my parents forever. Right? On 1st of December 1979, the report records that Mrs. Greenwood called the social worker to take me away. He writes,
"Spoke to foster parents on telephone. Both almost insisted that Norman had to leave today. I explained that we should discuss this. Arranged to see them on the 2nd of January 1980 with a provisional place in Woodfield arranged."
Norman Mills, my social worker, has since told me that he informed the foster parents that having made a commitment to me as their parents, it was not right for them to demand I be taken away. So I didn't go. It was the end of December 1979, and I was excited when I entered the front room for the family meeting because it was just me and Mum and Dad. I sat at the table and my mum looked at me intensely. "You don't love us, do you?" I said, "Yes, I do love you. We want you to spend the next day thinking about love and what it is. Read the scriptures and give us your most honest and truthful answer tomorrow." That was it. It was a clear instruction from Mum and Dad. I prayed to God and I read the Bible to see if a passage would answer the question. They wanted me to ask God for forgiveness, and through him I would learn to love them. And in the Baptist faith, a sinner must ask forgiveness for his sins. The theology was perfect, the timing unquestionable, and the answer as honest as a sinner could get. The next day came, and I said it with pride, because I thought I had found the answer that they wanted. "I mustn't love you," I said. I looked at their faces to see if I had said the right thing. "But I will ask God for forgiveness, and I'll learn to love you." This was the perfect answer. "Seek and ye shall find." My mum looked at me as if I had wounded her. "You don't love us? You don't want to be with us?" All of this happened the day after they had made a call to the social worker, who reports,
31st of December 1979. Message left after Christmas saying the Greenwoods wanted Norman removed without further discussion.
My mum wouldn't hug me as I left, so I hugged her. Norman Mills, my new social worker, ushered me gently into the car. The car filled with a quiet loss. Mum told me they would never visit me because it was my choice to leave them because I didn't love them. This was the beginning of empty Christmas times and hollow birthdays. This was the beginning of not being touched. I'm 12. I said to Norman Mills in the car, I know this is my fault and I will ask God for forgiveness. He pulled the car quietly into a lay-by and turned the engine off. None of this is your fault. I had no idea what he meant. If it wasn't my fault, why could I never return home? Night can't drive out night, only the light above. Fear can't drive out fear, only love. My 12-year-old self stood still between two doors in the hall. 2 feet in front of me, the clenched fists of the banisters to a grand staircase, bigger than I'd ever seen. My heart wanted to jump out of my chest and run away back to the greenwood so that I could tell them all about it. I didn't lean on the wall. My arms were by my side, my shoulders back. I stood like I'd been taught a good boy should stand. Hands out of pockets. Best behaviour. A boy appeared from nowhere. He was shuddering with excitement. So who da-da-da-da-da are you? He fired questions at me, none of which I could answer. His name was Jack. Hello, I'm Norman, I said and stuck out my hand for him to shake. How do you do? Jack stared at my outstretched hand as if I was an alien. He craned his head to the side with a bemused look. He raised both hands and twisted my ears and ran off whooping with laughter. I was still reeling when I heard the steps of adults. Norman Mills was with Mr. John Harding, a beer-bellied Manchester City supporter. He ran Woodfield's Children's Home. He showed me the dining room and kitchen. The cook switched on the industrial potato peeler. It filled the kitchen with the rumble of thunder. The steel teapot was twice the size of my head. The cellar was daunting. A low ceiling was lined with flickering strip lights. There was a room just a little bit bigger than the table tennis table that squeezed into it. Then the laundrette with industrial steam presses for the bed sheets, and a long walkway with benches and rows of shoes. There'd be many times in the future that I would play table tennis with myself by pushing the table against the wall. Backhand and forehand smash, defend and attack, spin, cut, lob, slice. My body would skip around the table and I'd narrate the game against Christopher, my invisible brother, and I'd let him win. All my personal belongings went in the locker by the bed. I asked when my clothes and toys would be arriving. They were in the trunk back at home, the one with my name on it, the one Grandad Munro made. But nothing was coming from there, not even a Bible. I had nothing to put in the locker. Over the next few weeks, the children's home filled with mainly teenagers. Most children in care have someone they can call family. I had no one. Peter Libby was my first friend. He was half Chinese, half English. He was a year older than me. Libby took one look at me and with a big smile he pronounced in a broadly accent, Right, Chalky White, that's you. And from then on, Chalky White was my nickname. I loved it. Libby introduced me to the new world. He wasn't necessarily the hardest guy in the home, but he was the funniest. Libby was highly intelligent, like the Artful Dodger. By calling me Chalky, my mate, he was shoring up against what he knew would be a tirade of unbridled racism. If I couldn't take a joke, I would be in for a rough ride. I'll never be able to thank him enough for what lay beneath this christening. Eventually, I came to hate the nickname Chalky White. But I can see now what Libby was doing. There were three huge boys' dormitories on one side of the landing, between 4 and 7 of us per bedroom. I hardly slept for the first month. The sheets were stiff and forbidding. The blankets were scratchy. On 4th of January 1980, the social worker reports,
saw Norman at Woodfields. He's insistent he wants to remain at Birchall High School. I'm aware that the Greenwoods do not want him to continue there as they feel it will cause problems for their son, Christopher. 18th of January, 1980. Norman's very unhappy about the prospect of attending Lee CE Secondary. Still wanting to see Greenwood family ASAP. Norman, however, embarrassed about going home. I offered to make arrangements for a Saturday visit. 26th of January, 1980. Norman escorted to foster home. Welcome for him kept on a low key and noticeable that the two older children nowhere to be seen. Greenwoods took Norman back to the children's home, but would not go to the door.
Norman Mills, my social worker, didn't understand that they had no intention of taking me back. I didn't understand it either. My foster parents said that they were my parents forever. They taught me to call them Mummy and Daddy. They trained me. They said they were mine forever because my birth mother didn't want me. They were my mum and dad. The reason I'm writing this book is so they can get a clear idea of what happened. I quickly learned my place with rotors and bells and wake-up time and shoeshine time. My life became a set of systems, and my existence was defined by how well I performed them. No love. I was becoming invisible. I'd been at Woodfields for 11 months. When the giant triangle rang out for dinner, the house sprung to life. Kids raced downstairs from the bedrooms, upstairs from the cellar, dived inside from the garden, off the roof and through the fire escape, every which way to the dining room. 2 hours after dinner was supper time, hot chocolate and a biscuit. After supper, we watched TV in our pyjamas and then to bed and lights out. Christmas Eve, 1980. I wasn't going to ask my social worker if I could visit the Greenwoods for Christmas. I wanted them to ask me not to be alone on Christmas Day. So I did what they wanted. I stayed away. As impossible as it was to understand, I grasped the idea that I wasn't welcome. My social worker reports,
"The unfortunate side effect is that Norman is now refusing to consider any move to another foster home because he cannot face the possibility of another rejection."
Children from homes all over the Northwest were taken to Blackpool to see national heroes Cannon and Ball, starring special guest Lenny Henry. That summer, mid-performance, he said, "I need one of you on stage." A Mexican wave of hands flew into the air. Me, 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 me. But all the children in our home screamed at Lenny Henry and pointed at me. Him, 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 him. Memories in care are slippery because there's no one to recall them as the years passed. I had to check to see if Lenny Henry ever played Blackpool. And there it is, in Wikipedia. "You! What's your name?" Lenny Henry was talking to me. I couldn't reply because the others were shouting, "Norman! Norman!" "Right then, Norman, come up here." Up until that point, I was nervous, but on the stage, I was unafraid. I was home. The stage lights made me shine. Look at this man. He's black like me, and he's a star. My first time on a professional stage was with Lenny Henry, and I can't remember any more than that. By now, I was famous at my school and in my area. I was Chalky White. He's up for a laugh. But it was all shielding an onslaught of daily racism. I had to be alert to punches and kicks from strangers, or phlegm flying across the classroom or pavement. I was in fight or flight mode. My main weapon was my smile, my guile, my ability to run. I loved the daily walk from Orchard Lane to high school with our gang from Woodfields down potholed Mill Lane. I loved the school because I could smell family on the other young people. I could sense their mums and dads, their packed lunches, their new football kits. Regardless, I held on to the idea that my parents, the Greenwoods, would come for me one day. But in truth, I was letting the idea go. The last hug from an adult was the stuttered one on the doorstep of their house. I'd been in the children's home for 360 days. I wrote a poem in the dormitory on my first day. It was about a tree. In writing about the tree, I wrote about myself. It was a discovery, a freedom. This is who you are. I knew there and then that I wanted to be a poet. The proof was there, on the paper. The evidence. I was alive. In the children's homes, the written word was rare. There were no books and subsequently no encouragement to read. The staff were too busy adjusting rotas and shifts. The act of writing would follow me wherever I went. At my high school, I was summoned to the office of the deputy head teacher. She had heard about my writing from my English teacher. There were two lights outside the deputy head's office. Red for stay, green for enter. The red flickered out, and after a pause, the green blinked on. Mrs. Jones had the teeth of Ken Dodd and wore jackets and trousers. "Sit down," she said. I sat, sharpish. She stubbed her fag out on her ashtray and walked around her desk. "I want you to have this," she said, and held out a book. It was The Mersey Beat, published in 1967, the year I was born. It was battered and well-read. In the first poem on the first page by the poet Adrian Henry, it mentions an orphanage. All I knew about being a poet is that a poet wrote poetry. It's all I ever wanted to be. I was 14. This was a flag in the mountainside, a base camp. But there were more pressing reasons to write. One boy from high school who lived in a house further up Orchard Lane asked, "So where do you live then, Chalky?" I said, "Woodfields on Orchard Lane." He looked at me quizzically. "My dad says it's a den of thieves." It became clear to me that the adults around me had no idea what to do with me. I was surrounded by teenagers who maybe felt the same. The home was bedlam. On 15th of January 1981, my social worker reports.
Visited Norman following a phone call from Woodfield staff. They explain that Norman has again been in trouble. He has accompanied a number of other Woodfields children in stealing eggs from the kitchens, which were then thrown at the home of a foreign doctor nearby. In addition to this, Norman is still suspected of glue sniffing, whilst his attitudes towards members of staff is beginning to deteriorate. Norman is the youngest of the youths at Woodfields, and it appears there may have been a lot of pressure on him to be part of the group, and thus to join in the antisocial activities. Spoke to Norman about all this, but he was in a particularly truculent mood and complained that he was being singled out. It was finally agreed with staff that we should attempt to move him to a family group home, preferably Gregory Avenue, in order to remove Norman from the influences of the older youths in Woodfields.
It was agreed with Gregory Avenue staff that I would be moved there in January. "Not lost," said the sun, at the start of the day, "just following instinct, just finding my way." I hated Gregory Avenue, and I hated being moved. I'd lost everybody again. The adults around me had no idea what to do with me, and that scared me. I was losing respect for them. I was well and truly part of the system. This was not extended leave. I was shown to my new bedroom. I despised the name of this place, a family group home. It was homely in the way a grotto in a shopping store is Christmassy. The staff were on shifts like elves in the grotto. There was an office from where I was passed pocket money each week, and a staff room where the staff smoked and talked about us. I was 14, and I was confused. Norman Mills, my social worker, writes,
Norman has been particularly prone to swings of mood, which one assumes are largely related to his stage of development. However, he does appear to be harbouring a great deal of resentment concerning the two major rejections in his life, i.e. first by his natural mother and then his foster parents. I feel that this is the source of much of the intolerant behaviour that he displays from time to time.
When I was tucked into bed, the staff wrote their reports. The reports seemed only to document anything untoward. My well-being was defined by how many marks were against my name. I was 3 years away from leaving care. I started to ask questions about my origins. A 14-year-old boy should never have to ask the question, who is my mother and who are my family? Because the question comes with others. What did I do to deserve this? Gregory Avenue was in a village called Atherton. I spent 3 years in Gregory Avenue, but as much time out of it as possible, like any teenager. The home was on the edge of Hag Fold housing estate. I got to know everyone on the estate. Tony Concannon ran the boxing club in Atherton, and his wife worked in the taxi firm next door to it. I'd spend evenings at their house, smoking, drinking cups of tea with them and their kids. I took whatever affection and acceptance I could from anyone who knew me. I was the boy from nowhere, from nobody, who was everybody's somebody, Chalky White. My social worker records,
Norman is very interested, naturally, in knowing more about his parents and how he came to be in care. Told him again what I know of the situation and of the difficult position his mother must have faced, e.g. being a young unmarried mother in a strange country. I did suggest the possibility that we could write to his mother's last known contacts in Ethiopia, but warned Norman not to build up hopes prematurely.
I had been on Earth for 14 summers, and to ask me not to build my hopes up was heartbreaking, given that all I had was hope. I was introduced to Bob Marley by a friend on Hag Fold called Lyndon Marsh. I was nearly 14 when Marley died and Island Records were pushing out music. Lyndon was a huge fan. He introduced me to Marijuana at the same time. I was spellbound by the album Survival. It flooded into my bloodstream. Marley shouted down the forces of oppression. How can you be sitting there telling me that you care here? In his words, I heard my own story and felt a growing pride. We are the survivors. Yes, the black survivors. He spoke of suffering, history, and of Babylon. He would be my guide. I dropped the name Chalky White. It was no longer a joke. By 1983, I had been in Gregory Avenue for 2 years, and I was becoming what Rastafarians called conscious. I left school with few qualifications and started a Saturday job on a stall at Lee Market that sold household detergents and toiletries. I started in the early morning with a bacon butty and hot tea. I was good in the market. I liked the quick-fire humour and the work ethic of the markets. I was smoking marijuana heavily by now. I graduated from the market stall to door-to-door deliveries. Mr. Waddington drove the transit van, crammed with tubs of bleach and detergents. And from the van, I saw a bit more of the world, the reality of the 1980s industrial landscape. I handled money for the first time. To a 15-year-old, it was great work experience. Money in my pocket, the big wide world. During one of the trips around Bolton, selling household detergents on an estate called Dobble, the atmosphere changed. The streets were quiet. The doors were daubed with red swastikas. I tried knocking on a door, then a second. I could hear a baby inside. Footsteps, and then nothing. My guts churned. I told Mr. Waddington about the swastikas, and he said, yeah, it's where Packies live. No point knocking on those doors. But I felt closer to them than I did to him. There were riots all over England in the 80s. Brixton, Toxteth, Bristol. The last one was in Moss Side, Manchester. The papers were full of rampaging youths. I was the people around me feared the most. I changed, seemingly overnight, from the cheeky chappy, the happy-go-lucky joker, into a threat, and it hurt me. I couldn't unsee the shopkeepers flush red from the neck upwards at the sight of me, or the store detectives following me in shops. At the bus stop, I couldn't unsee the woman clutch her handbag. I couldn't unsee the police cars slowing down deliberately as they passed. I was afraid and angry. The marijuana didn't help. I found another job at a clothing factory. I became an apprentice cutter. The women worked in rows of giant sewing machines like on Coronation Street. They received packages of material from a chute on the floor above. That's where the cutters were. Three old men with tape measures around their necks and me, the apprentice. There were three long tables, each the size of a billiard table. Raised slightly above the table on a cylinder was a roll of cloth. With chalk the shape of a shark's tooth, I drew patterns onto the material using cardboard stencils. The Eastman cutter was a vertical automatic saw with a finely serrated blade. "Put it on side up cloth, that's right, lad, and push this lever down. Now press the red button and cut around the shapes. That's the way." Smoking cannabis at such an early time in the development of my brain was not good, but anything that would take me away from the madness seemed reasonable. I dabbled in LSD and magic mushrooms too. Other worlds opened up inside me and I couldn't control them. My mental health deteriorated rapidly. I started to walk via back streets. I didn't want to be looked at. The sewing machines at the factory were like tanks drilling into my head. The noise tormented me, and I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't smile. I opened my mouth, but nothing. No words. I couldn't go back to work. I could barely walk to the shops. The world started to stutter like a faulty VHS video. My head was falling apart, and the people in the home didn't seem to know. They worked in 4-hour shifts. They couldn't see what any parent would have seen in their own child. A mental breakdown. There were 5 days till Christmas. It was the one day in the year where it became obvious that I had no one. My contempt for the adults around me was difficult to hide. One of the staff wrote a report describing abusive language and aggressive behaviour, and said she wouldn't be answerable for her actions if it happened again. It was a threat, but it was also a signal that I would have to be moved. 4 days till Christmas. 3 days till Christmas. 2 days till Christmas. On 23rd of December 1983, Norman Mills, my social worker, writes,
"Conference at Gregory Avenue, at which Norman made aware that he was on probation concerning his behaviour and that he would be moved, probably to Wood End, if he stepped out of line again. Norman truculent and negative afterwards, and it wasn't possible to hold any sort of conversation with him. He is allowed to remain at Gregory Avenue for the present."
Meanwhile, my social worker had also been trying to find my mother.
"The Secretary, North British Conference of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Dear Sir or Madam, I'm writing to you in the hope that your church may be able to help a teenage boy in the care of this authority, to trace his natural mother's present whereabouts. Briefly, the facts are as follows. In 1967, a young student named Yemashet Sise arrived in Wigan from Ethiopia.
"Dear Mr. Mills, I've discovered that Yemashet Cisse had at one time been secretary to the principal of our college in Ethiopia. He has suggested you write to the president of our church there.
At Christmas, my social worker gave me letters copied from my files.
4th July 1968. Yemashet Cisse. Ethiopian Union Mission. Addis Ababa. Dear Mr. Goldthorpe, you might have wondered where I disappeared. I got a telegram telling me I had to come home because of my father's serious illness. I found my daddy at the hospital, and it took me a while to recognize him. He is just skin and bone, but somehow he is still alive. Could you please help me in answering the following questions? 1. If I want to get Lem out here, what steps should I take? I would very much like to bring him. Lem needs someone to take care of him. He needs to be in his country with his own color, with his own people. I don't want him to face discrimination. 2. Could you give me his foster parents' address? Very sincerely yours. Yemashet Cisse.
They lied to me. Someone did love me. My mother. Norman Goldthorpe replied to my mother's letter.
2nd of August, 1968. Dear Miss Cisse, I was very surprised to receive your letter and to find that you are back once more in Ethiopia. I realise that it would be best for your son to be amongst his own family, but I must take very great care. He is in very good hands at the present time and is with excellent Christian folk who are doing extremely well for him. I'm afraid that I cannot give you their name and address. This is because they may eventually adopt him.
It didn't take long for my joy at receiving the letters to turn to anger. My birth mother did nothing wrong. She wasn't poor. She wasn't destitute. She didn't abandon me. She did nothing other than find herself pregnant while in England and ask for help. Norman Mills gave me my birth certificate. I looked at my name. It wasn't Norman Mark Greenwood. My Ethiopian name. The name my mother gave me. The name on my birth certificate. I am Lem Cisse, I said to myself. My name is Lem Cisse. Lem Cisse. My name is Lem Cisse. My name is Lem Cisse. If Woodfields was bedlam, Oakland's was feral. Out of control. My anxiety and depression tightened its grip on me. I sought solitude and walked alone at night. I couldn't stop thinking. I found an arch over an old road. No one could see me, so I sang into the reverb of the arch. I sang Marley songs and recited my poems. I became more and more insular. Norman Mills warned me that Wood End had been mentioned. So I told him. I had to tell someone.
February 1984. Norman has now informed me that he is suffering from certain symptoms which I would assess as being of an anxiety-phobic complaint. He walks down back streets to avoid the public in general, and generally reacts to most people in a verbally aggressive manner. Case conference at Oakland's. See minutes on file. Agreed that I should contact GP and psychiatrist re Norman's mental state.
The reason I wanted the doctor was so that my condition would be on record. I asked to see a psychiatrist following on from the doctor's diagnosis. Nothing felt safe around me. I needed help. Most of all, I needed witnesses. I knew I was having a breakdown. I'd been in children's homes for 4 years. I still had no family. On a midnight walk, someone shouted at me, "What you think you're doing round here? Wog. Weirdo." A few days passed, and I saw their pretty garage door and I kicked it. The police came. On 20th of March 1984, I stood before Lee Juvenile Court. I received a one-year conditional discharge. Within days, the authority arrived and called a staff meeting with appropriate social workers regarding control. This was 1984, George Orwell's 1984. I was in a tailspin. On the one hand, I had the authority hounding me with the threat of Woodend. On the other, I had the police. May 21st would be my 17th birthday, which left me 12 months until the care system was going to throw me out. I returned to the Greenwoods to ask for photographs. My foster mother sat me in the posh room, like a visitor, and opened the photo albums. She shielded the photographs from my sightline, as a child shields his food at the school dinner table to protect his chips from being pinched. I felt belittled. I had no proof of my childhood. I needed photographic evidence that I once belonged somewhere. Catherine carefully extracted four photographs. She closed the album and asked me to leave. But I had more questions about my birth mother. My foster mother flew into a rage and slammed the album on the floor. She phoned my social worker and demanded he take me away. I ran away from Oaklands at night. I walked the East Lancs Road to Moss Side in Manchester, nearly 14 miles. I sat inside the doorway of a record shop a little further up from the Reno nightclub. It was 2 a.m. and I watched people talking, walking, laughing. Beautiful, dark faces. But I looked quite threatening, bedraggled, wild-eyed, fearful. I arrived back at Oaklands at daybreak to the police. On 21st of June 1984, Norman Mills reported,
"A case conference was held this afternoon at which the decision was taken to move Norman to Woodend for a period of assessment."
I was taken immediately. Norman Mills drove me through Lowton, Lee and Atherton, through the gates of Woodend Assessment Centre. We were both silent. He didn't want me in here. I had been in care of Wigan Social Services for 17 years. The idea that they wanted to assess me now was a joke. This wasn't assessment. This was imprisonment. There was a smirk on the officer's face. "Welcome to Woodend, young man. We do things differently here." I was marched to a utility room. An overweight man with a thick bunch of keys slapped down some regulation clothes. I was marched to the sports hall and sat at a table. The food came in one tray with bowls moulded into it. Woodend was deathly silent. I was being reprogrammed. "You have 1 hour a day for recreation," the man said. He opened the door into a plain room with chairs lined against the walls where boys were sitting. They barely looked up. "Unlock. Lock." I was taken deeper inside. There were two sorts of child inmates. Young people on remand, awaiting court appearance, and young people in care. It was a technical difference because we were all treated like charged criminals. I was under surveillance 24 hours a day. I was marched along the corridors in size order with the others, in silence. Anyone who stepped out of line was beaten. There was no outside now. This was a lock-up. Reprogramming meant I had to have a psychological test to determine whether I would be put into labour or education. Nothing in the assessment centre had any validity in my eyes, including the staff. But I had to be careful to avoid a beating. How to comply and yet not comply? The test asked questions such as, "Are you a tree in a forest or a tree on a hill?" I replied, "I am a poet tree." The hierarchy were displeased and brought in a school psychologist to assess me.
Thank you for asking me to see this young man. As you know, Lem completed most of the tests in a non-serious way. He also rejected the idea of completing an individual intelligence test for me. I think he was casting doubt on the validity of the tests, and although not a point of view that I personally subscribe to, it is certainly not unreasonable for an intelligent person to adopt. When he was asked to write about himself, he decided to write a poem to, as he says, capture a piece of emotion. It is as follows.
They told me this was me, my family, my home, but I still ended up alone. Once again, I packed my smaller suitcase, another loss of trust on a wild goose chase. Like a knot in a shoelace, they thought they did it best, but the more they pulled, the harder the case, and who ended up with less? And now, through the jungle of paper, theory and pen, I just only find out my name is Lem, and I've been cheated, beated, pushed and hit. Now my name is Lem and the fire's been lit. Now, after I learned, they say I must learn. Throw water on the fire and the fire still burns.
The spirit of Bob Marley lives on. I applaud Lem's courage. He's better off making his own mistakes, given some degree of support, than having decisions made on his behalf.
The authority were not happy with this letter from the educational psychologist, and a few days later, they made their own report.
Wigan Social Services Department Assessment Centre. Sisse treated the testing procedure with complete and utter contempt. The reliability of his overall score is thus questionable.
The dormitories were locked at night. Because of the red night light in our rooms, we couldn't see out of the meshed glass slit in the dormitory door, but the night watchman could see in. I try to keep sane. I try not to get my head smashed in by the officers. The men. I grew my dreadlocks. I twisted my afro hair each night. I write poems every day in recreation hour. They chart the journey. In my writing, there are no limits, no boundaries to the imagination. There's a freedom. My hair rises into a knotted mass of twisted spikes, and then the locks drop into a crown of dread. Dreadlocks. The psychologist I saw had found information on the National Association of Young People in Care, NAPIC. I wrote a pleading letter to a determined, quietly spoken woman called Margaret Parr. She worked with NAPIC and set up an affiliated organisation called Black and In Care. She came all the way from Manchester to visit me. Visitor protocol? The sports hall was lined with tables. The staff stood at the front, the sides and the back of the room. We boys were marched in and placed by our seats. Margaret Parr looked at me before sitting. She was the first outside person who could see the shit I was in. I was an experiment that hadn't worked. She believed me straight away. There are many of us, she said, all around the country. Black kids, fostered or adopted, then thrown back into the care system when we reach 12 or so. She had been in care too. This isn't right, I said. They say I'm here because they're waiting to put me in a flat, but it's been ages, and this is a prison. Margaret could see what it was. Don't let them drug you, she whispered. I had a plan all along. The system at Wood End, run by the men, was based on privileges. I gained privileges for good behaviour. Privileges meant I could work unsupervised, digging the gardens of the staff homes. So I ran. I ran away to the housing office of Atherton Town Hall. I approached reception. Hi, can I see the housing officer? It's urgent. What's your name? Peter. I saw a leaflet on the board for Royal Bank of Scotland. Peter Banks. I hated that lie. Eventually I was ushered from the waiting room. My name is Lem Cisse, it's not Peter Banks, and I need to tell you, I am in Wood End, and they're saying that they're waiting to find me accommodation, but I shouldn't be there, and I have no family, and it's a prison. My social worker will tell you everything. Will you talk to him? He listened attentively and told me that he'd do his best. I was trying to kick-start the system. Back then, nobody told me that it worked. But it's here, in my files. On 19th of October, 1984, my social worker writes in the report.
Norman has approached Atherton Housing Department for a council tenancy and has made a favourable impression, it appears. When I spoke to Mr. Wilson at the department, he confirmed that Norman could be offered a tenancy.
By mid-December, I was in my flat, my first home. I was 17 and a half. I lived on the newest housing development in Atherton. It was called Poets' Corner. My one-bedroom flat was 21 Cowper Avenue. The streets that surrounded mine were Blake Avenue, Chaucer Grove, Keats Close. Somebody left a gift for me outside the flat. I don't know who. It was a thing of beauty to me. A black Olivetti typewriter with a waterfall of ebony finger pads, each ingrained with one mother-of-pearl letter.
Lem Cisse was reading from his memoir My Name is Why. Letters and reports from his files were read by Sean Baker, Susan Jameson, Sean Mason, Catherine Press, Nahel Tsegai and Greg Jones. The abridger was Julian Wilkinson and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
Der Schlangenkur toujours.